Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to The Art Detective with me, Dr. Yanina Ramirez. I'm an Oxford art historian, a lecturer and a broadcaster, but most importantly, I'm your chief investigator of images. Today, I'm joined by a fellow art historian, so it's going to be proper nitty-gritty art history today, people. I'm joined by Dr. Bendor Grosvenor, and you are an art historian, a specialist on the artist we're going to be dealing with today, but you've also dipped your toe into television presenting a lot, haven't you? You're currently on Britain's Lost Masterpieces, is that right?
Yes, Britain's Lost, and we're doing a second series of that, which is very exciting.
Excellent. I love it. I love the idea that you find these hidden gems. That's what you're good at, isn't it? Sort of reattributing lost masterpieces.
Well, thank you. I've been lucky enough to find a few interesting lost pictures, and my favourite artist who we're talking about today, and who I've been also lucky enough to find a few lost pictures by, is Sir Anthony Van Dyck, yes. On whom I'm a slightly obsessive anorak. So I'm very glad to have the opportunity to talk with you about these amazing pictures by Van Dyck.
And we are, of course, in the presence of one of his greatest works. We are in the National Gallery in London. What are we looking at?
Well, we're in the Mond Room in the National Gallery, which is sort of ground zero for a Van Dyck anorak like me, because it's chock full of his lovely portraits. And we're standing in front of his equestrian portrait of Charles I, which is painted around about 1635, I think. And it's sort of almost double-decker big, isn't it?
It's huge. I think I read it was 3 metres 60 by almost 3 metres across. It is a whopper, isn't it?
Yeah.
It completely dominates the room. Am I right in thinking it was originally meant to hang in Hampton Court? Is that
it
right?
It hung at the end of a gallery in Hampton Court, yeah. Mm. So it was designed to basically intimidate you. If you, we're very used to images these days. We see them everywhere. But if you could imagine being a gent or even a peasant or someone in the 1630s, and you've never seen portraiture on this scale, this level of fidelity before, to suddenly come across this image of King Charles I on a horseback in the landscape around a corner in Hampton Court, it must have been absolutely extraordinary to see. I mean, talk about doing a double take.
It's a complete image of power, isn't it? And
yeah.
If we give a little bit of description of it, so we've got this enormous horse, but with a remarkably small head.
Yes, a lot of people focus on that, actually. I think our image of a horse has changed as the evolution of the horse has changed, or the breeding of the horse has changed. So probably the head is, it looks small to our eyes, but I think it's probably as it was in those days. It's one of these, it's basically a fighting horse, isn't it? It's a massive, great, solid beast. You can see its muscles rippling in the light, and the king is sitting serenely atop of it in his suit of armour, looking very in control.
Well, he does, doesn't he? And again, I did a bit of thinking about Van Dyck and how he became the court painter for Charles I. And one of the issues with lots of people painting his portrait was, of course, his height. He was a small king, wasn't he? He was, 5'4", something like that?
He was 5'4", and I think he'd had rickets when he was
Wee
boy, yes.
Ah.
And he was very much the runt of the litter.
Oh.
And so he clearly, you know, he had we call it a Napoleon complex today, but he, part of the reason he lured Van Dyck to Britain and commissioned him to paint pictures like this was because he wanted to compensate for that.
Yeah.
the fact that in reality he was small and weak, but in pictorial image, through Van Dyck's brush, he was strong, majestic, and above all, kingly.
Mm, and the use of the horse in these portraits, because this isn't the only equestrian portrait, is it? He was often painted on a horse.
There were Van Dyck did three horses of pictures of the king with a horse, and this is the most politically important, I think, because in this one he's very much in control of this strong, muscular beast. And I sometimes come into this room with my pair of binoculars, and I would urge everyone to do that too.
Because this is the anorak in you coming out
anorak,
again.
Yes. Or the poor security guards think I'm some sort of cat burglar or something. But if you look at the mouth of this horse through binoculars, you can see that actually it's foaming at the mouth.
Yes, which I think you can see a little bit there of the spittle just coming off the muzzle.
Yeah, it's drooling. And that is, I think, a symbol of how vigorous this horse is, and how the king, who is looking very serene and calm, is able to control it with a light touch. He's holding the reins with one hand.
Yeah.
So this is obviously a metaphor for kingliness in charge of the kingdom of Britain.
Mm, and he's positioned really as a philosopher king as well, isn't he? He's contemplating, he's thinking, he's not rushing headlong into battle. There's something quite serene about the whole composition.
Yes, I think you could say that. I mean, the landscape looks quite calm, doesn't it? But we have on the right here a page who is offering up the helmet. So there is a feeling that the king is wearing tilt armour, so I think there's a feeling that he's about to go into some sort of battle or contest. Mm. Clearly he's going to win.
There's a high level of fantasy in this, though, I read, because the tilts hadn't really taken place since 1616, I think. And so the idea that he actually ever was going to ride at the tilt is slightly fantastical. But that's how he wants to be seen, isn't it?
Yes, I think anyone who's 5'4" and wanted and suffered, who was a thin man, you wouldn't be playing jousting, would you?
No, it's not a sensible idea. Although the horse would do pretty well, I think. That's a pretty magnificent horse. There's lots of symbolism going on around this image, isn't there? Do you want to point out some of the little secret hidden bits that are going on?
Well, I think it's quite nice to see on the tree there's a little carved plaque which says Carolus Rex, was it Magni Britanni? So he's claiming to be king of Great Britain. So the formal union of Scotland and England has not yet taken place, but Charles is saying he's king of the whole island. There's no mistaking it.
It's certainly a big statement, I think, at this point, because if we're thinking 1630s, 5, 6, 7, it's not yet reaching the crisis of civil war, which comes in 42, but there is still grumblings and people are not happy with this king, are they?
No, and I think that's obviously the great irony of this picture, is that Charles was far from in control of the kingdom. And when it came to the battle, he lost, and he lost his head.
Mm.
On a broader point, I think you can sort of dare to draw a parallel in English history, at least, between kings who love art and kings who are good kings.
I completely agree.
And so Charles I is top of the list, who loved painting. He used to collect pictures from all over Europe. He would play games of attribution by candlelight when they came into Whitehall Palace. He would open up the crates and go ecstatic about his latest Titian. But he was no good as a king. And I think you could say the same for someone like George IV, can't you?
Mm.
Henry VII, who was a great king, couldn't really give two hoots about art.
No, absolutely, yeah. I think that's a really excellent point. And again, I think this is why the guise of the sort of philosopher king kind of suits him. And he's... It's interesting. I find a really interesting contrast with the art of the court in Spain at this time, because Velázquez is painting the Spanish court and he's really muted, always in black, always very severe and strong looking. Whereas this is sort of Baroque flamboyance, isn't it?
Yes. Well, that's part of Van Dyck's genius. If you were to compare the portraiture available to someone like Charles I, in the 1620s even, it was very static. There was no movement. There was no idea that someone could paint a realistic image of a horse moving along like this. And so that is why Charles put all that effort into luring Van Dyck to Britain in 1632. He promised him a knighthood, a pension, a gold chain worth 200 quid, an apartment in a palace, basically all the trimmings Van Dyck got, in order to help create these fantastical images which made the king look, and I suppose feel, more monarchical than he really was.
It's real propaganda in that sense. I mean, we can look at it as a stunning piece of art that's beautifully executed, beautifully painted, but there's an awful lot of messaging going on with this, isn't there?
Yes.
And the timing is crucial. But in terms of Van Dyck's style, what is it that has made you quite the obsessive about it?
Well, I mainly got into art history through portraiture, and for me there's no one better than Van Dyck in terms of not only painting a likeness of someone, but allowing their character or what one can discern to be a bit of character to come through. Often I think with portraiture it's a sort of battle between the ego of the artist and the sitter, and sometimes the ego of the artist steamrollers any semblance of the sitter, and they're just made to become a caricature. Rubens, for example, is a great painter, but he's not a good portraitist. Whereas Van Dyck allows the sitter to really come out in the portraits, and I think that's what I love about his pictures. And of course, he was such a great technician. Mm. This was a guy who was painting portraits commercially from the age of 13, and he could paint as easily as you and I breathe.
Amazing. And he was he trained by Rubens?
He spent a long time in Rubens's studio. Yes. And basically the artists, the great artists available to Charles I, were in Northern Europe, Rubens and Van Dyck. And they tried to lure Rubens across. It didn't really work out, although they got the amazing banqueting hall ceiling.
Oh, yes.
But he wasn't playing ball, so they got Van Dyck. And Van Dyck, of course, then goes on to transform British portraiture, because we're seeing repetitions of Van Dyck's influence on British portraiture right up until the 19th century with people like Lawrence and then later Sargent. And he totally transforms, in a way, the way we see ourselves in Britain as well.
That's very interesting as an idea. So, okay, that's worth exploring, isn't it? So is it the drama, the style? What is it then that's leading to this sort of long connection with Van Dyck's portraiture?
I think it's the fact that he allows a real human presence to come through in portraits. Until Van Dyck arrived, it was all about statements of whether your costume was looking golden or blingy, the lace was good, and very much the identity of the person was subsumed. When Van Dyck comes along, he can allow a canvas like this picture of the king on the horse to look like a real person on a real horse. And in Britain, we're particularly fond of painting ourselves because we've had the Reformation, so we don't do religious art.
Of course.
And we don't really go in for history painting. We're a little bit egotistical, and we love to have pictures of ourselves on the wall.
So, it's either ourselves, our houses, or our gardens.
Or sometimes our horses.
Or our dogs.
Yes, yeah, dogs and horses, yeah.
And that's the sort of the contents of most stately homes.
Yeah, and Van Dyck creates the template for that.
Amazing. I hadn't thought about it all coming back to Van Dyck. How interesting. I mean, there's a tension in this, isn't there? Because we're in a room where there are other Van Dycks around. And I think when you see the variety he can bring to these characters, with Charles, I always feel maybe that he's very much at the service of the image of power. And I don't know if I'm getting the real Charles I coming through.
I think that's a fair comment, actually. And particularly for these royal portraits, there is a visual tradition that Van Dyck is having to operate within. So if you consider that one of Van Dyck's early portraits of Charles is what we call the Great Piece, where he's sitting with his wife and kids, it's the family picture. It's on the same scale as this massive one in front of us. And that is very much following on from the famous Holbein mural of Henry VIII and his family. And you've got to have this idea of life-size images of the royal family looking kingly and also in charge of the nation. The nation, the family is the extension of the nation. And I think another thing that we don't often associate, remember with this portrait of Van Dyck, of Charles I on horseback, is that Charles is consciously bettering the portraits of his brother, Henry, Prince of Wales.
Right.
Who, of course, was destined to become king, but died. Charles got promoted up the line. And for this exact composition, there was already a portrait of Henry on a horse like this by Robert Peake, who was not a great painter, bless him. A for effort, Robert, but you weren't as good as this.
So he has bettered his brother in that respect. Where did that... Was that in a prominent place?
Yes, it would have been. And I think it's really a case of sibling rivalry here.
Oh, wow. But also, I think, rivalry with other European courts as well, because, again, with Charles, wasn't he supposed to be betrothed to to a Spanish queen and then a princess and then ended up marrying a French Bourbon princess. Is that right?
Yes, there's this rather pathetic mission that Charles first goes on to Madrid to try and woo. He's sent packing. But actually, when he's there, he forms one of his great passions for art and sees all the Titians and what have you.
And he is rather obsessed with Titian as well. We should sort of see this in the tradition of Titian's work as well, shouldn't
yes,
we?
And I think that's one of the reasons that Charles and Van Dyck bonded, because they both loved Titian. And if anything is influencing Van Dyck here, it is Titian. Mm. There's an equestrian portrait of Charles V on horseback, very like this, by Titian.
Yeah, very important piece, that one, isn't it? That's influenced a lot of equestrian portraits. And actually, the idea of the equestrian image, sculpture, portrait goes right back to imperial times, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And it's, in many ways, not only a symbol of power, but it's also a way of showing the virtuosity of the artist, isn't it?
Yes, I think, yeah.
Because I remember reading about the sculptures of horses, that to do a bronze, for example, of a horse is incredibly difficult because you've got this huge carcass of heavy metal and just a couple of little sticky legs that you have to get to balance. So if you can show a leg raised, that shows that you were even better as a sculptor. But I do think that the way that he's done the horse is particularly effective and dramatic. It's interesting the way that the horse almost resembles Charles. There's the sort of the wavy, dark hair, isn't there?
Yes, I hadn't noticed that before. Maybe. God.
But there's other things too. The fact that he's in armour, obviously that's supposed to bulk him out and show him as a strong warrior. Yeah. He's wearing the Order of the Garter as well, is that right?
Yes, isn't it? And a chain there, that's the preeminent order of royal chivalry.
So he's tying himself back to a tradition of chivalry, but also this idea, I suppose, of the divine rights of kings?
Yes, and look how that one worked out.
It was getting a little bit outdated by this point, so he lost his head for it. But I do see it. I love images that show you a moment captured in time, and this for me is Charles trying to almost hold back the tide of what will become the Civil War and what will become parliamentarian uprising with this, I think, quite, in a way, backwards referencing image. It's referencing old masters, it's referencing imperial power of the past, it's referencing knighthood and chivalry.
Yeah.
That all contrasts with what Cromwell comes in and does, doesn't it?
Yes, and you'd never have had Cromwell sitting for a portrait like this. Although what's interesting, actually, in the interregnum is that this kind of imagery becomes so associated with power, not just royal power, is that the parliamentarians then carry on being painted as if they were being painted by Van Dyck.
Oh my goodness.
And there's an engraving of one of the equestrian portraits of Charles I by Van Dyck, which then gets the head of Charles rubbed out and a head of Cromwell dropped into it, sort of classic cut and pasting from the 17th century.
That's amazing.
So although Cromwell himself would have been deeply uncomfortable with, you know, sitting for an egotistical portrait like this, he was still there, nonetheless sort of dragooned into complying with the imagery that Van Dyck had associated with authority in Britain.
How amazing that it even went that deep, yeah. I mean, I'm interested about this idea of, I suppose, the dropping in of details, because when you see such an enormous canvas like this, can we say that it's all Van Dyck's hand, or is he working with people?
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands.
They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I think in a picture like this, it's one would call it all autograph.
Okay.
I mean, every detail is pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And probably had assistance, you know, to help him prepare the canvas or put in the what we call the ground layer, that sort of thing. But you wouldn't call this Van Dyken Studio.
Okay, okay. That's important, isn't it? Because, again, I think it's one of these things we tend to have lost track of as time's gone on. We forget that there are schools, there are studios where perhaps the master might only drop in and do the face or the hands.
Yes.
And then the rest will be done by students. But this is all, this you feel this has his touch all over it.
I think it does, yeah. I mean, Van Dyck, like all contemporary painters in that period, was quite naughty about seeing what he could get away with. So there was a famous case where he was asked to send some royal portraits to Spain.
Uh-huh.
And when they opened them up, they soon realized that he'd sent studio copies, but he charged them for the real deal, you see.
Ooh.
But he was only, you know, behaving like Rubens, who was very open about his sort of, you know, price scale for the amount of involvement that Rubens directly put in himself.
So he'd learnt from Rubens how to do the business of art, really.
Oh, definitely. I mean, we often forget. It's our 19th century, sort of 19th and 20th century ideal of the artist as a sort of romantic, labouring lone hero.
Exactly.
But they were small businessmen.
Absolutely.
And functioning much as any small business would.
Mm. Yeah, we completely get bamboozled by this idea of the biography, the genius, the frustrated individual.
Yeah.
And this is work for work to commission. It's in a way, it's to decorate great palaces, it's to make big statements. This is a poster for the campaign of Charles as king, isn't it?
Yeah.
In lots of ways.
Yeah.
And does this actual image get reproduced in any other formats?
Good question. I don't know off the top of my head, but I'm sure it would do.
Because once you've got something as iconic as this, the other one I adore is the one with the triumphal arch, where
yes.
the horse is sort of storming through.
Yes.
And that's got a drama to it. This one's much more peaceful, I tend to think. Do we know where it's set? Where in the landscape it is at all?
Not a clue, actually, no. There's someone's PhD thesis in that.
There isn't there, because I can definitely
out.
See a little bridge down there. He's done the sky absolutely beautifully, I have to say.
Yes.
And how do you go about attributing a Van Dyck? What is it that you look for with the eye of the connoisseur? What do you see?
I think you're just, first of all, the first thing is the quality. And I know that's a very subjective thing, but once you've seen enough Van Dycks, you can begin to discern where Van Dyck's own hand is coming in, as, say, compared to a studio assistant or indeed a later copyist.
Mm-hmm.
But in pictures like this, where the quality is pretty knockout, it's quite easy to discern. But, you know, there are other sort of telltale signs, which actually I think we can see in this picture. One likes to see what we call pentimenti,
yes.
which is, you know, evidence of the artist changing his mind. And I think on this picture, from where I am, you can't see it, but there are various changes in the horse's feet and legs, I think.
You can almost make it out, can't you, against, yeah. So, oh, wow, okay. So that again, that would show creative process, that he's working it out on the canvas, going
yes.
back, correcting it.
Unlikely to be the work of a copyist. I mean, it's not hard and fast rule, but these are some of the things we would want to see.
Okay. And, I mean, there is something distinctive about the way he does. I was looking at the portrait down there of the three children, and the gold, the metallics, the way that he gets light into his paint, I think is
yes,
remarkable.
Yes. Yes, I mean, again, these are very subjective considerations, but with Van Dyck, when you're seeing a Van Dyck autograph face, you get a sense of a sort of bones beneath the flesh, and like, as you were saying, with the costume and the armour here, you get a sort of tangible sense of metal that you can almost tap and it would go ping. Whereas the work of a copyist would be much more two-dimensional, flat, lifeless, in fact.
Mm. And have you found any Van Dycks, then, in your investigation?
I have found a few. In fact, I was delighted. One of my favourite finds was a self-portrait of him, which we found in an auction in Cologne in Germany some years ago. It was being sold as a copy, but it turned out to be the real deal, had been substantially overpainted. And actually, last year, it was on display here in the National Gallery.
Oh, I missed it.
Yeah, and they had it, and they had a poster of it outside and facing Trafalgar Square.
Oh, that's such a wonderful thing to be.
Which I posed for many selfies in front of.
My life achievement. But it is something that I come up against when I'm teaching art history, is, you know, we come from a discipline that is incredibly diverse, and there are so many different types of art historians. Mm. And I mean, I sort of sit, I think, more in the camp of the iconographer, the symbol reader, the person who likes to see an image as a historical gateway almost. Mm. But then at the other end of the spectrum, the training of the eye of the connoisseur, the person who can tell from the pose of a hand, or, you know, the way that ears have been painted, mm. which artist has painted it, where, how.
Yes.
That's a skill, obviously, that you've learned to develop over many, many years.
Yes.
How do you go about that?
It sounds quite mystical, but actually it's just practice. Uh-huh. And in the same way that you can, you know, when a letter drops on your doormat and you can recognize from the address the way it's written, without opening the letter and seeing the signature, you know who sent you the letter. And it's a bit the same with this game. You just have to spend ages looking. Close looking. That's why I go around places with binoculars, because it's not just good enough to stand back and go, "Oh, that's a lovely picture." You've got to actually stick your nose to the canvas and really get to know how the artist worked.
And is this something then that you were doing even when you were very young? Were you into painting?
I wasn't actually. No, I got into it quite late.
Oh.
I have to confess, I never studied art history. I'm a historian by training.
That's okay, I'll let you off. I actually did English literature before I got into art history, so I was all about the poetry. And yes. But yes, I think it can come late in life, can't it, the passion
yes.
for it.
Yes.
But that's really interesting. So you've given yourself all these skills relatively late then. You've had to go and look extensively.
Yeah,
across
and it's been what a fun profession. I can't. I'm so lucky to do it for a living. Mm. Sniffing pictures. What fun!
Do you get involved with any of the chemical analyses of these things? Because I think science
very
is
useful.
Moving it in a really interesting
yes,
direction,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, very useful.
I mean, when you founded Van Dyck, did it have to get sent off for scientific analysis?
We did things like X-ray and infrared and all that stuff, which revealed, you know, that he changed the position of his hand.
Oh.
And so that was a good sign. And it told us how he'd built up the various ground layers. The science can usually tell you what something is not.
Uh-huh.
And it can tell you that possibly this came from Van Dyck's studio, because that's how he painted.
Okay.
But he may have taught someone to paint like him. So in order to kind of judge whether it's the artistic genius mm. of Van Dyck himself, you sort of still need the human eye.
It is remarkably unscientific, as well as being quite formal and scientific
yes.
in itself, isn't it? There's still that element of doubt and ambiguity with every great
yes.
work that comes up.
And that's part of the problem of connoisseurship, and the reason it's got a slightly controversial air in art history mm. is it's damn difficult to explain it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm standing here struggling to explain to you how I know that's by Van Dyck, because it's a mental process
absolutely.
That I can't really explain.
But I love that analogy of the handwriting on a letter. I think you're absolutely right. And it is the case that you do... I try and teach my students across the course of, you know, 3-4 years that they should, after a while, almost intuitively understand how artists compose their
yeah.
scenes, how
yeah,
they
yeah.
arrange their materials, what subjects they're drawn to, what colours they're drawn to.
Yes.
I mean, I think that what's
good for
interesting
you.
About Van Dyck is that he does use relatively muted colours here,
yeah.
but that's not across the board, is it?
Well, no, that's why he, in connoisseurial terms,
mm.
he's a very difficult painter to get your head around,
mm.
because he changes his style almost every 2 years. No, not completely changes style, but, you know, a picture from the 1620s by Van Dyck would look very different from one from the 1630s.
How interesting.
And you can, often people will go to a Van Dyck exhibition and feel like there's 3 or 4 artists at work,
mm.
but that's because he was so good.
So good, but also, didn't he, I mean, he must have been influenced by each place he went to, because he's trained in Antwerp.
Yes.
And then he goes to Genoa, does he?
Genoa, yeah,
yeah.
And Sicily.
And Sicily.
Yeah.
And then, of course, he comes to London. And
yes.
wherever he is and whichever patron he's working for, he's almost, I suppose, adapting slightly to his
yes.
needs, to
yes.
the needs of his patrons.
Yes.
And does that affect it then, the place that he's in? How he
certainly, when he's in Italy, he's much more influenced by the likes of Titian.
Mm.
And the very interesting and revealing thing about him biographically is when he comes to England, he lets go a bit. He doesn't try so hard.
Oh.
And you get a lot of what we call and studio pictures when he's painting in England.
Oh.
So sort of pictures where he's not really put in the effort.
Is that because he's just on this cushy number? He's got this paid up check from the king?
I think it's because he knows that in England he can get away with it.
Because there aren't the discerning...
There aren't the discerning connoisseurs here.
Oh,
and our artistic standard is way beneath anything on continental Europe. And indeed, we're reliant, as you know, in English art on immigrants until the 18th century.
Absolutely.
Because there's no native school.
Yeah.
So he's coming here, he's not being impressed by Robert Peake. He's thinking, oh, I can get away with this. And charge, you know, extra.
That is so interesting. I forget, I mean, this again, it's the way that we read our own nation's history. We tend to prioritise our concerns, our dates, our great figures. And yet, we were an artistic backwater for many, many centuries, weren't we?
Yes, yes. And then Hogarth comes along and changes everything.
Makes it better.
Yeah.
Makes it better. Breathes a bit of life into it, definitely. I mean, there's so much more we could say about this image. I think that the fact that there's so much symbolism, because is that an oak tree behind as well that we've got there?
Good question. God, I don't know.
I'm just reading it for symbols because that's the sort of nutty thing I like to do. But listen, we could carry on talking about this endlessly. It's such a pleasure to talk to you because I am not a connoisseur, and I find the whole world of buying and selling art frantically kind of bewildering. I know what I consider to be valuable art, but it's often art of a zeitgeist, art of a spirit.
Yes.
Whereas to actually put value on art, I find that very difficult.
Mm.
I really respect what you do, and
oh,
I'd love to
you.
Come and see you at work one day. What's
oh,
your connoisseurial art?
Yeah.
Your connoisseurial eye, you kind of do your job. Thank you,
Brenda.
It's been
great
absolutely
pleasure.
Fantastic. We'll have to do another one another time.
Mm.
You're on Twitter, aren't you?
Yes, Art History News.
Art History News. I love following you on Twitter. I am on Twitter too. I'm Dr. Yanina Ramirez. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, you can download the rest of the series at historyahit.com/artdetective. I hope you've enjoyed this exploration of one of the biggest and the best equestrian portraits here. Thank you, Bendo. It's been wonderful.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.